Is Governor Christie Noem being treated unfairly in the national press, or is she merely reaping what she has sown? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Wednesday, March 17th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Dakota Political Junkies talk about a new Rolling Stone feature that calls Governor Noem a COVID queen and a snow queen. We welcome the Sioux Falls Sports Authority for a look at how legislation that bans transgender girls from the field might impact games and tournaments in the state. We preview the state boys' high school basketball championships with Craig Maddock. That's coming a little later in the hour. But first, Seth Tupper joins us for an update on the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints compound in the southern Black Hills. And we look at what all this snow means for spring. We begin with the news. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The South Dakota Board of Regents says all state universities plan to ease COVID-19 restrictions this fall. Six public universities and two special schools will add more in-person classes and events. Kurt Hackamer is the provost of the University of South Dakota. He says USD will phase out social distancing measures and mask mandates beginning late August.
For the fall semester, we are planning for a return to normal classroom activities, normal social activities on campus, normal event schedule and normal event practices. That would mean classes that are at full capacity. That would mean hopefully no masks, and that would also mean no social distancing.
Hackamer says the decision comes in response to South Dakota's low positivity rates and widespread vaccine availability. University officials say current plans may change if COVID cases start to rise. A Black Hills National Forest Committee is accepting proposals to improve forest ecosystems in western South Dakota. The Black Hills Resource Advisory Committee has about $90,000 for projects that maintain or improve land health and water quality. Kelly Warnke is the coordinator for the committee.
So projects like that could include treatment of noxious weeds, soil erosion mitigation. We have done erosion control along Sheridan Lake.
Projects are limited to the Black Hills National Forest or lands within Custer, Lawrence, or Pennington counties. Warnke says pre-planning can make proposals more realistic.
We really encourage project proponents to talk with their local Forest Service office. If you have a recreation project you have in mind, you know, talking with a recreation person on the district will give you an idea if we have the environmental clearance to go ahead with that project. Environmental clearance can take a lot of time.
April 2nd is the deadline to submit proposals. The AARP is expanding a grant program that funds community-based projects. They award the money each year for quick action projects to make towns and cities more livable. The National Association advocates for people over 50. It first launched the Community Challenge Grant Program in 2017. Grants can range from several hundred dollars for small, short-term efforts to several thousand dollars for larger activities. Lindsay Holmquist is with the AARP of South Dakota. She says this year they will consider projects that align with current issues like the COVID-19 pandemic or social justice challenges.
Coronavirus relief, so if there are any projects related to kind of getting back on your feet after COVID, and also diversity and inclusion while improving the social environment in the community.
Holmquist says the grants offer ideas for community improvement. She says each project benefits all residents.
And that can range for everything from public and outdoor spaces to community connectivity, feeling included in what's going on, communication.
The AARP of South Dakota awarded nearly $70,000 in grants around the state last year. Nationally, the association gave more than $2 million through the program. Today's weather, partly sunny skies in the west, mostly cloudy skies east, with highs in the upper 30s east, central, and southwest to the mid-40s across the state. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. That sunshine does not negate the fact that many South Dakotans have been shoveling their way through some wet and heavy snow these past few days. Well, what does the current snowpack mean for the days ahead? Mike Gillespie is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service, and he joins us with an update. Mike, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori.
Well, often when we get a large, snow event in March, we're concerned about spring flooding. Not the case this year. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we did pick up a pretty nice snowfall out of this last system that came across basically the southern half of the state. But the good news as far as flooding goes is that we had been so dry in most of the state going back, even a year ago in eastern South Dakota, and a little bit less than that in the west. We've been looking at moderate to severe drought conditions across over 90% of the state on the latest U.S. drought monitor. So the dry conditions that we had going into this spring, the snowpack that we've got out there right now that we got out of this last snowstorm really does not have enough water that's going to cause any flooding, and it's actually going to be very beneficial to help alleviate some of that dryness and drought we've been experiencing.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about whether the speed with which it melts matters to sort of soak up that moisture into the soil. What can you help me understand that better? Like, what do we want to happen next in these areas that are looking at these several inches or a foot of snow?
Yeah, again, luckily we had that nice warm stretch, temperatures 15 to 30 degrees above normal earlier in the March here, and the majority of the frost in the soils had thawed, at least from I-90 south. Areas, again, farther, in the central and northern part of the state still have some frost at, 2 or 3 feet down, but that top foot of soil has pretty much thawed. So as this snowpack slowly melts over the next several days here, that water's just going to soak down into those soils since they are no longer frozen. So again, everything played out just about perfect as far as, not having a pre-existing snowpack before this storm, getting those soils to thaw out before this snowpack came, and the moisture again is going to be very beneficial.
Yeah. New drought monitor update is expected this week. Any major changes in that? What are we thinking?
Yeah, the new drought monitor will be coming out tomorrow morning, probably around 8 o'clock. Right now, just based on some of the precipitation amounts that we've seen over the last week here, I would imagine that we are going to see some improvement in some areas. Until that map comes out, I won't know for sure exactly how much improvement's going to be shown anywhere. But just the fact that we finally got some pretty decent moisture and starting to get some moisture into those soils, we should see those drought conditions start to improve at least across the extreme southern parts of South Dakota.
Yeah. So now let's talk about a little longer range outlook, 90 day for the weather and the rivers. What can you tell us is ahead? Because March is unpredictable, and sometimes so is April.
Right. Yeah, we are in that, that springtime where we can go from snowstorms to 80 degrees. We've seen that, over the last couple months where we've had some really cold stretches, really warm stretches, and I don't see anything in the near term that's really going to change that. We are going to be warming back up again by this weekend. Probably see normal to above normal temperatures for part of the last part of March here. Looking ahead, right now as you get into the late spring, April, May, we are kind of looking at increased chances of above normal temperatures. Precipitation-wise, though, right now there's really nothing we can hang our hats on these long-term forecasts that are going to kind of weigh the dice either towards dry or wet. So, kind of keep watching things on that 1 to 2 week time frame. Those are going to, these systems that are coming out, exactly where they're going to set up and who's going to get hit, that's really going to determine whether we see dryness creeping back in again or if we continue to see improvement.
Yeah. For people who are waiting to dig for construction projects or building projects or backyard work, That's a different outlook than if you're working in agriculture. Any way to predict when those kinds of projects can start scheduling, or is that just really specific to the industry that you're in and the project you're doing?
Yeah, it's going to really be determined by what you're doing. If you're looking at a big construction project or something like that, and again, what area of the state you're in. Once that frost is out of the soils and the soils are dry enough that you're not trying to bring equipment in and getting them stuck in the mud, things can probably go ahead. I don't see any real cold snaps coming up that would put us in danger of having of refreezing any of those soils again right now. So I think the fact that we have seen the frost come out of the soils, a lot of these construction projects can probably go ahead as soon as the soils are dry enough.
Mike Gillespie is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Thank you, Lori.
Seth Tupper is up next. We'll talk about the Southern Black Hills compound sale. We'll have all the details for you in a minute. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, Kazuo Ishiguro, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2017. His novels, Remains of the Day and Never Let Me Go, were adapted into films. Born in Nagasaki 9 years after the atom bomb, he moved with his family to England when he was 5. Book critic Maureen Corrigan calls his new novel a masterpiece. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by ReliaBank, personal and business banking solutions, reliable services, and a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank, a brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Beginning March 29th, weekday mornings on SDPB will sound a little different. Starting at 9, 8 Mountain with 2 hours of 1A, followed by On Point at 11, 10 Mountain. Then join the team from In the Moment as we cover stories about South Dakota told by the people from South Dakota. It's all your favorite shows, but at new times, starting March 29th on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Missouri River Energy Services, working in partnership with our 61 member communities to provide energy and energy services that support citizens and help sustain local business. MRenergy.com.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh.
We're going to go ahead and sell it for $750,000 to bidder number one. Bidder number one for $750,000.
That is audio from a recent sheriff's auction that oversaw the sale of a compound in the Southern Black Hills. It was previously owned by a secretive sect of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. SDPB's Seth Tupper has been covering the stories for years, and he joins us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio. Seth, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back before we go forward and tell us a little bit about this sect and who they are and their leadership, because it's been quite controversial over the years.
Right. So the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS, as it's usually referred to, broke away from mainstream Mormonism decades ago. And I've seen various dates as to when that happened, in the late 20s and the 40s. But suffice to say, many decades ago, there was a splinter. And this group, the FLDS, continued to practice polygamy, which the mainstream Mormon church had renounced long before that. And so, you know, the church went along for the FLDS went along for decades under various rulers that they called prophets. And in 2002 was when the FLDS really came onto the national radar. That was when Warren Jeffs, who was the son of the previous prophet, took over, and things kind of deteriorated from there.
Yeah, deteriorated because he was criminal. He was deranged. He was a lot of things. Tell me about Warren Jeffs.
Yeah, so he, when he took over, he married some of his father's late wives, and he married many, many other women and girls, some girls as young as 12. I've seen reports that he fathered perhaps more than 60 children with more than 70 wives. And, of course, this the word about this got out. The feds got interested in that. There was a manhunt for Warren Jeffs. He ended up going on the run. But he was eventually captured and convicted of sexually assaulting girls and was sentenced to life in prison in Texas, where he is still imprisoned. But not before he had seen fit to direct some of his members and leaders to go to South Dakota and start the compound that we're talking about.
Okay, so this is near Pringle, right?
Yeah, so basically 15 miles southwest of Pringle, or if people are familiar with Custer, maybe about 25, 30 miles southwest of Custer.
Just tell me where it is compared to the Hitch Rail. Just kidding.
Google Maps.
So, all right, yeah. all right, so he built this up here, and there wasn't much known about this comp. Like, what do we know about what, through your reporting over the years with the Rapid City Journal and now with South Dakota Public Broadcasting, what do we know about how many people lived there, what their activities were?
We know at the beginning, you know, I interviewed, there's a couple named Carl and Suzanne Von Rump who had the misfortune of buying their property and building their retirement home right next door to where the compound was eventually built. They didn't know that when they bought their property. But in the early years, for several years, there was constant construction as FLDS members and leaders were building lots of houses and dorm-like structures and barns, and they built a guard tower there, and all that activity was very quick, so there was a lot of disruption to neighbors at first. Then things kind of quieted down, and you know, they're very secretive inside the compound, and people didn't hear a lot from them or of them. But I did have an opportunity a few years ago. Roy Jeffs, who was one of Warren Jeffs' sons, who escaped the FLDS and got out and tried to lead a normal life. He came to Rapid City several years ago during a screening of a documentary about the FLDS, and I interviewed him. And he had actually lived at the South Dakota compound for a few years. And he talked about just life there was, he didn't really know how many people lived there. He was kept segregated from the women. He was a young man, and he was basically made to work from sunup to sundown every day, working on building projects and things like that. He did say there were young girls there, according to him, that looked like they were pregnant or had children. He reported to me that he had seen people in the compound poaching wild turkeys and deer to feed people in the compound. They also had large gardens. So it was a very regimented lifestyle. He also talked about they had a security camera system set up. They had a guard tower. Whenever anybody approached, according to Roy, an alarm would go off and everyone was ordered to go inside and not have any contact with outsiders. So it was a very secretive, very controlled society. Sadly, Roy Jeffs, who gave me all this information I interviewed, really struggled with some of the things that had happened to him in the FLDS, and sadly committed suicide just a couple of years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that. How does this compound end up on the auction block? Help me get to this point where we're at now.
Right. So the FLDS is, you know, since Warren Jeffs was imprisoned, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, has had a lot of legal troubles. And they're really based in this community called Short Creek, which is on the border of Arizona and Utah. And, you know, years ago, the state of Utah seized a lot of church assets in that community. And as part of that, some of those assets got sold or given away and came under new ownership. So there was these three former members, three men, who had agreements to use some of the land that formerly belonged to the church to farm or ranch on it. And but FLDS members kept these men off of that land and wouldn't let them use it, and even went to the extent of arresting them to try to keep them off that land. And so these three men ended up filing a lawsuit. They ended up being awarded more than $2 million in judgments against the FLDS. The FLDS did not pay, and so these men went about looking at FLDS assets and convincing judges to seize these assets, put them on the auction block, and use the proceeds to pay the judgments. That's how we get to what happened in Custer County, where these men filed a lawsuit and said, we're still owed this, you know, much of this $2 million. Mm-hmm. They asked a judge to seize the compound and put it on the auction block, and that's what happened.
And you talked, you went to that auction that day, talked to the men, set that up for us.
Yeah, so it was in the lobby of the Custer County Courthouse, and there was about 40 people there, including a number of people that registered as bidders, maybe five or six, and then maybe 30 or 40 just onlookers. And if anybody's ever been to, you know, like a foreclosure auction, it was just like that. A deputy went up the stairs so he could see everybody and look down on the room, and you know, just conducted the auction, asked for an opening bid, and it went from there. There was some bidding, and you know, it started at 500,000, and it went up to 700,000, 750,000, and nobody outbid though the three men that had the judgment against the FLDS. So they get the property. They don't actually have to pay for it. What happens is, that value then is subtracted from the judgment that they're owed from the FLDS. And I did talk to one of the men. His name's Patrick Pipkin, and he talked about why he's doing this.
I do want to let people know that this corruption of this church is coming to an end, and we are a part of that side that's helping correct and make a difference here and for other places where there's other locations that they supposedly own.
All right, what's next?
Well, you know, these three men don't actually take ownership yet. There is a redemption period, kind of like a foreclosure, where the FLDS would have a chance, if they can pay off the $750,000 or whatever, to actually keep this property. So there's a year redemption period. In that time, the three men who have been tentatively awarded the property are concerned that perhaps people who live in the compound, reportedly there's about 20 people there now. It used to be perhaps maybe 200, according to rumors and reports. But the three men who've been awarded the property are somewhat concerned that FLDS leaders or members who are there might remove personal property and try to basically drag a bunch of stuff out of there and to take all the value out of the compound.
Yeah. You can find Seth Tupper's reporting on the FLDS compound at sdpb.org/news. You can also find the work that he did with the Rapid City Journal on this topic and more at rapidcityjournal.com. Seth, thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll be back in a moment. Dakota Political Junkies will talk about that Rolling Stone article that criticizes Governor Kristi Noem for her COVID-19 response, calls her the COVID queen and the snow queen. That's up next. Listener supported SDPB.
A lot of companies have left their buildings empty of late. People have gone remote, but some are thinking of moving back in.
There are smaller tech companies, there are smaller professional services firms. Now is kind of the time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Office Ghost Towns. Coming up next time on the program, also the numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news. It's all from Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. 50,000 miles of resilient broadband fiber supporting online banking and other essential businesses right where you need it. More at sdncommunications.com.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Boys State Basketball Tournament. You can watch all the action Thursday, March 18th through Saturday, March 20th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Boys State Basketball Tournament, brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corps.
Program funding is provided by Black Hills State University, Rapid City, offering programs for students and working professionals, and the home for the new Center for Hospitality and Business and the West River Health Sciences Center. More at bhsu.edu/rapidcity.
You're You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem frequently says on national news programs that the media is not treating her fairly. Today, we're going to examine that in light of a Rolling Stone magazine feature that calls Noem South Dakota's COVID queen and a snow queen. That latter moniker refers to Noem's snow queen title years ago. So joining us for that conversation, we welcome Mike Card, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota, and John Schaff, Professor of Political Science at Northern State University. John Schaff is joining us from the Tom and Danielle Amann Foundation Studio at NSU. Professor Schaff, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. Always good to be on with Michael.
And Professor Card, thanks for being here.
I'm humbled to be here with each of you.
All right. Let's start with this Rolling Stone piece, which I pulled up and read yesterday and now is frustratingly behind a firewall for me. But it's written by Stephen Roderick. He's a senior writer at Rolling Stone magazine. And it just starts with that line, "At first, the angel of death skipped over South Dakota. This pleased the Snow Queen." And it sort of unfolds from there. Mike Card, this is just getting a ton of shares on social media. It got a response from Maggie Seidel with the governor's office. And we'll talk about Maggie in just a few moments because she's actually transitioning out of her role there. Governor's office called it sexist and irresponsible, I believe. And lots of people online are saying it just expresses the rage and frustration they feel about Governor Noem's, pandemic response. But I want to talk about the article itself and what it kind of represents. Mike, what were some of your first impressions as you read through this, if you were able to get past the firewall?
Well, yes, because one advantage to having articles forwarded to you is they are often accessible through the paywall. I received 10 copies of this yesterday from various individuals around our state and in other states. And I too read it yesterday. And I think the first thought I had was it did seem to be picking on Kristi Noem. So in that sense, I decided to take a look at what articles have been written about Governor Noem and found that there are basically two types. There are very supportive articles on Fox News and other assorted places, and then there are the rest of the media, which does not take a very kind look at Governor Noem. And this is one from Rolling Stone that it's more or less in a I don't treat it as a credible news source. It's a piece that points out what some of the population believes about Governor Noem's handling of the coronavirus in South Dakota.
Yeah, let's talk about
that. I'll let John weigh in on this.
Yeah, and Rolling Stone in general has a history of publishing screeds. You know, this is Hunter S. Thompson territory. This is, something that is we've come to expect from Rolling Stone's coverage in the past. John Schaff, some of your early thoughts?
Well, the difference between this and Hunter Thompson or P.J. O'Rourke, who also used to write for Rolling Stone, is they had a sense of humor. And this is relatively humorless. I was talking with my students in American political thought yesterday. We're looking at Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And I was trying to come up with a word for when you're angry for the sake of being angry. And one of my students very helpfully pointed out that word is spite. And I said, yes, that's the word I'm looking for, spite. And in our politics today, there's a lot of politics of spite, angry for the sake of being angry. And this might be an example of the journalism of spite. You know, a few weeks ago when I was on, Lori, Jonathan Ellis talked about the, people might recall the New York Times little video they put together on Kristi Noem's COVID response. And I don't want to put words into Jonathan's mouth, but he said them on the air that this wasn't very high level journalism on the part of the New York Times. And this is in a similar vein, is that there's not even an attempt to, there's plenty with any politician to criticize them about. And there's always honest criticism, but this piece seems to be that there are people who agree with the author, that Kristi Noem is equivalent to the angel of death. And then there are other people who are either fools or knaves. And so there is no attempt even to consider Kristi Noem's point of view or to give it an honest, even semi-charitable reading. So this, as Michael suggests, there seems to be a trend, and this is one of those trends, which is, I would just call it a journalism of spite when it comes to Kristi Noem as she raises her national profile.
Here are a couple things that I think are worth pointing out, and the first thing is the inaccuracies in the piece. They get the mm-hmm. first gentleman's name wrong, and many of us have had to double-check whether we have typed Brian yeah. or Byron, and they do refer, Stephen Roderick does refer to him as Byron. There's some geographical errors that people from South Dakota have pointed out on Twitter, and he said he was going to make some adjustments as far as what highway he was on. There's some directional kind of confusion as he was traveling throughout the state. So for me, as a journalist reading something, once you get to that level of, and that's not the only thing. There are things that he says she said that she just never said, as far as I can tell. And inferences that I don't think she was ever inferring. So there's a lot of inaccuracies. And then I want to take up Maggie Seidel's point from the governor's office, who emailed South Dakota media about the sexism in the piece. Now, very early on, she's called the Snow Queen. That's a reference to a title she had when she was younger, which she has said, you know, was an opportunity for her to learn how to speak in public. And there are all kinds of queens across the state of South Dakota. I don't think that Kristi Noem is ashamed of being the Snow Queen. And this author is really kind of holding it up as some. So do you think when you read it, did you find that there was sort of this relentless marginalization of her as a female governor, from comments about what kind of dress she wore on the 4th of July to this whole Snow Queen theme, to her smile, to things like that? Did you find an underlying sort of, you know, sexism to the piece, Mike?
Yes, but I probably didn't catch it until it was pointed out, and then you look for it and it's there. One of the pieces that I looked for was to see who the readership of the Rolling Stone periodical is, and it's 63% male. So he may be appealing to his base, just as he's accusing Governor Noem of appealing to her base. I think that it's unfortunate in our society that we judge women based on how they look and what they wear and the appropriateness of their behavior and other aspects of their personal life that have no influence on their professional behavior. And I wish I knew how we could stop that, but I think this is one example of that.
Yeah. For people who haven't read the article, John, one of the things about, he says, you know, she dresses as a rancher and wears jeans and a trucker cap, but then, you know, at the 4th of July, she wears a sleeveless, you know, red dress. And on behalf of women everywhere, I just like to say, if you're going to give a speech in front of the President of the United States, you might wear a dress. If it's 4th of July, you might want to go sleeveless because it's warm. And if it's red, you might just be trying to be seen from the crowd. So I don't think I would take the podium in jeans and a trucker cap at the presidential event. It's frustrating for me over the years, John. I'm sure that you've heard me say this before, but the number of times people, and Maggie Seidel has done it. She has sent us emails with like an article that they really thought was flattering of the governor, and it talked about how pretty she was. It makes me frustrated personally that so many people say, why are you wearing that hat today? And she has to answer, because I didn't wash my hair. Can we just get over that, please? And I think it almost makes it worse for me that 63% of the readership is men and that he might be writing toward a male audience. That doesn't make it any better for me.
Well, I have to say, Lori, see, you've educated me on this. When I first read this, I had in my head, I bet Lori Walsh really hates this stuff about the red dress. I thought of you because no one ever pays attention to how male politicians dress. No one ever comments, next to never, comments on how, but it's regular that they comment on how women dress. So that's, I had a Lori Walsh moment. You've educated me on this. And I think you're right, is that, now I think, especially because of the tone of the piece, there's a consistent attempt to belittle Kristi Noem, and even though the Snow Queen stuff, and the fact that like everybody who has a public life, they care about how they look. I do too when I speak in public, but no one comments on how I look, which is just the better, because it'd probably be highly negative. But this is something that female politicians, including Kristi Noem, have to deal with that male politicians don't, is that there is a constant comment about what is normal in public life, is you pay attention to how you dress and how you look. But for some reason, I think we know the reasons, that it seems to be a heightened, something worth commenting on for women, but not for men.
Yeah. And there are some exceptions to that. Before I get emails, Donald Trump's hair, Donald Trump's weight, Barack Obama's brown suit, and Dusty Johnson's pink tie, which he does not wear. It's an orange tie. So there are times when people really target certain politicians based on what they're wearing. Marco Rubio's USF gear comes to mind.
Oh, politicians who are, remember when Paul Simon, the politician, not the singer, always wore a bow tie?
You're right.
But
yes.
But those are affectations. It's not in the regular course of things. Right. And that's really what we're talking about.
Yeah. Mike, you wanted to say?
No, I was going to say the other one is age. Quite often,
Women
who are in positions of leadership that will say, Kristi Noem, 56, or I don't know her age, but it would list as a parenthetical comment what the woman's age is, and that's not relevant.
Yeah.
But it's still there.
All right. There is in this article also a reference to an old woman with a clipboard and an old woman, a kind old woman. So also, generously, there are more than one kind of old woman in Stephen Roderick's world. Sorry, Stephen, but maybe some other description would probably be worth the time there. So, all right, we've had a little fun with this, but the bottom line is, you know, it's a difficult article that really does point out a lot of criticisms that other people have brought up against Governor Noem's response. And I, you know, this is purely my opinion, but it's awfully hard to get to those when you have to sort through inaccuracies and, you know, some of the way this is writing. But again, writing to an audience for the Rolling Stone and really getting a big response here in South Dakota for some people who have wanted this kind of expression of their anger and, to John's point, probably spite. And for accuracy's sake, Governor Noem is 49 years old. So
thank you.
Mike Card, thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
John Schaaf, thank you as well.
Thanks, Laurie. Thanks, Mike.
In a few moments, we're going to talk about sports tournaments in South Dakota, and we'll preview the state boys basketball championships. But first, let's hear from Terry Rodert, activities director for the Huron School District. His job is to coordinate all aspects of sports and fine arts participation, scheduling, and events. It's a job that presented new challenges month by month through a year of COVID-19. Here is Terry in his own words.
You know, when we shut down, we didn't think we're going to be shut down for the rest of the school year. We thought we'd shut down maybe a couple weeks, and we'd go in and really clean the buildings and get everything disinfected, and lo and behold, we were closed for the year. And then we just met as an administrative team often and just tried to come up with a plan for distance learning to get through the season or get through the school year, tried to convince people that the masking is going to be key to this. And our community has done a phenomenal job with the masking. They really have, and that is what's gotten Huron through it. Well, I think what we learned is that masking works. We've been in a masking mandate in Huron since day one, and I think that has a lot to do with our success with our activities. We also have a healthy student initiative, so that's been well received by the community, and our coaches and our kids have done a great job monitoring their symptoms. We test them every day and make sure that they don't have temperatures before they come to practice and talk to them about symptoms. And that if not feeling well, stay home. And our parents and our kids and coaches have done a great job this year. Believe it or not, it's been a great year. Yes, it's been different. It's been challenging, but we've been able to get through all of our fine arts concerts and all of our activities with no interruptions, so we've been very fortunate. It's easy to say it's all about the kids, but then you have to have the action and stick with your plan, and that's what we've done. It's not that you want to get into arguments with people about the masking and that, because some people just aren't going to wear it, and that's their choice. But they have to respect our position, because that's what we really wanted to do. We really wanted to get through championship seasons in every season, and we did it in the fall, and we've got it done now in the winter, and we're going to do it in the spring, and it's going to be an amazing story where a lot of states shut down, South Dakota kept going, and we did it right.
Terry Rodert was also in charge of Girls B basketball tournament last week in Huron, managing the facility, staff, and volunteers. This week, the activities directors in Aberdeen, Rapid City, and Sioux Falls are on duty for the boys basketball tournaments. We will preview those tournaments with Craig Maddock in a moment. But first, what might the impact of legislation that bans transgender girls from girls' sports teams mean for tournaments like the Summit League in South Dakota? That is coming up next on In the Moment. You're listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Lisa Mullins, a generation that knows little more than loss. That's the fallout from the Syrian civil war that started 10 years ago this week.
We pass ramshackle camps. With each bombardment, more of them blotted the countryside. A decade, for so many, a lifetime of compounded trauma.
On the ground in Syria, next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Gene and his team of experienced insurance advisors will insure your home with your specific needs and budget in mind. GeneHufford.com.
These days, the scene at home is busier. Hands full, meal in the oven, a dog begging for your attention. With so much going on inside, how can you stay connected to what is going on outside your home? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR. You'll get the latest news from your community and beyond. We'll keep you company while you keep things moving.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
Sports and Recreation Reporting is supported by Horton Incorporated of Britton, South Dakota.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We'll preview the state high school boys basketball tournaments in a moment. But first, House Bill 1217 is waiting for Governor Kristi Noem's signature. Proponents say the bill, as written, would promote continued fairness in women's sports. The bill would prohibit the participation of transgender girls on sports teams designated for girls. Many feel the repercussions of HB 1217 will cause some states and organizations to boycott the state, and some are already saying that they will. Thomas Lee is executive director of the Sioux Falls Sports Authority, and he joins us with his perspective. Thomas, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori, very much. Thank you for having me.
So this is not the first time, I think it's the seventh time, some kind of transgender bill has tried to find its way through the state legislature. I believe Governor Dugard vetoed some efforts in the past, and now we're having the conversation again. But before we talk about this particular legislation, leading up to this, is this an ongoing thing for the Sioux Falls Sports Authority to sort of be monitoring coming out of PEER?
It sure has. For the last few years, of course, we've been monitoring it and have lobbied against it and testified against it in the hearings that these bills are placed in. We know there's already been a precedent set with North Carolina that there will be economic ramifications beyond the discriminatory factor and the human element of this. There's economic ramifications, whether that's sports, conventions, concerts. Businesses that were planning to relocate to North Carolina pulled that consideration. We believe that that exactly is what would happen here as well with a lot of our marquee events. And again, that goes beyond just sports. It's conventions, concerts, and business relocations, et cetera. So, of course, we and the Chamber and several other entities here in Sioux Falls, let alone around our state, are always monitoring these types of what would be seemed or deemed,
like anti-transgender sort of legislation is how they're
exactly.
How
discriminatory,
they're,
yeah. I guess. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So if, specifically from the sports and tournaments, you know, we talk about the Summit League or NCAA tournament or, you know, people coming from out of state to play other tournaments. What is, the potential impact of this then economically?
So just the Summit League alone, if we're sticking with just the Summit League men's and women's basketball tournament that we've hosted, I believe, since 2009 here in Sioux Falls, that has an annual estimated, or I should say average, impact of about $5 million on our community. And, of course, most of that is within the hospitality community. Again, can't speculate that the Summit League would go away if this bill were signed into law, but the ACC went away in North Carolina, which, of course, is a collegiate conference, when the NCAA went away. So if that NCAA domino falls, then it seems like there's a couple more dominoes behind it that fall. And we can only speculate that that may happen with the NSIC that we host here or the Summit League that we host here. And that tournament alone, the basketball, is a $5 million annual impact here to Sioux Falls and our state.
So, again, that leadership from the NCAA and other nationwide organizations has a big impact on which way other organizations go. Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct. Yeah, it's not, yeah. I don't think in North Carolina, and I worked in North Carolina at the time. I've kind of lived through this already. I held a similar position with Charlotte's Visitors and Conventions Bureau. And the NCAA doesn't dictate that the ACC or the Summit League not play those tournaments in that city or state, but that's typically how that fallout has happened, is leagues and different teams have seemed to follow the NCAA's lead in that decision making.
Do you think this bill protects girls' sports, protects the integrity of women's athletics?
So we all want to protect women's sports, right? It's the most obvious statement in the world, and the bill is cleverly written from that aspect. They can claim that it's not discriminatory because we just want fairness for women. I can't state this enough. There is already fairness. The South Dakota High School Activities Association already has a policy in place that if a transgender athlete wants to participate in a particular sport, there's an application process they have to go through. That process has been in place since 2013. And one time a transgender girl has been approved to play a girl sport. One time. There's been several others that have been denied. So the process in place already works. It already protects women's sports. So to put this into state law is just unnecessary, completely unnecessary.
So the process that we already have in place, which took months, years to plan out, that's a different process than a state like Connecticut would have. And that state's troubles were used in the debate and the argument in Pierce. So is it safe to say that our process is different than some of these states who have had different complications with transgender athletes?
Vastly different. Connecticut's policy essentially is if a boy feels like a girl or he identifies as a female, then he can play a female sport. It's as simple as that. Ours is not. Ours is not a one-day, two-week, two-month decision. It is a month-long process that requires verification from medical personnel, proof of lifestyle, among other things, that are reviewed by our board here in South Dakota that will allow or not allow that student to participate.
Thomas Lee is Executive Director of the Sioux Falls Sports Authority. As of this moment, I believe that House Bill 1217 has still not been signed by Governor Kristi Noem, so this is an ongoing story, and we'll bring you updates as they happen. Thomas Lee, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori.
The boys' state high school basketball tournaments kick off on Thursday. Tournaments take place in Aberdeen, Sioux Falls, and Rapid City, and you can watch on South Dakota Public Broadcasting Television, Craig Maddock, and online, of course. Craig Maddock has the call in Aberdeen, and he joins us now with a preview. Craig, welcome back.
Lori, it's always great to talk to you. We need to talk more often, not just at state basketball.
I was just going to say, it kind of feels like a while, doesn't it? So I miss you, Craig Maddock. I'm glad you're here.
Well, it's great that we're talking state tournaments. Let's face it, what happened a year ago affected a lot of folks. Yeah. And you know what? We got through the high school football season. We got through volleyball. We got through soccer. Got through wrestling. We got through the girls' tournament last week. And by golly, good chance we're going to get the boys done this weekend. And that is good for everybody.
That is good news. Precautions being taken. Not everything is over with this pandemic, but we are planning a full tournament. Tell me a little bit about Class B in Aberdeen and some of the teams that have made it to quarterfinals.
Well, the top seed is the Smith. It is a team that has like four players that are three-year starters. They're like 66-3 in the last 3 years. They are certainly the top seed. They like to go up and down. And one of the fun stories is the team that they will play tomorrow, Lower Brule. It was a team that had to fight its way through the SODAC 16, and they beat Potter County. And, you know, Lower Brule has only been here one other time in their history. So that's a fun story. And then you got Aberdeen Christian. How about Aberdeen Christian right out of Aberdeen? You know, they made it to the tournament the very first time last year. Of course, everything got canceled last year. They have made it back, and they get to play in their hometown. That will be a fun story as well. And then White River, 16 years in a row. White River will be at the B Boys, and that's coming off the girls winning their first title last week. Can they do something that's never been done in Class B basketball? That's the girls and the boys winning a title in the same year.
Wow. All right, so who does White River go up against first to try to make that happen?
They are going to go up against Del Rapids St. Mary, and Connor Libis plays on that team. He is right now the number three all-time scorer in South Dakota boys basketball history. That will be another story we'll follow during the B tournament.
Yeah. Based on the precautions, is there a home court advantage for Aberdeen Christian, do you think?
You know what? It's a school that has about, 200 kids? In the school.
Okay.
You know, when you look at, you got Aberdeen Roncalli, you have Aberdeen Central and Aberdeen Christian. How about that? You got three teams that have been involved with state tournaments here this year.
All right. So those semifinals will be, quarterfinals start Thursday, right? And semifinals on Friday, championship on Saturday. What can you tell me about Class A?
Class A boys, Vermilion is the top seed. They have been looked at as the top team all season long. And then you have Dakota Valley right there in the southeast corner of the state as the number two seed. And then I think you got Sioux Falls Christian and Sioux Valley, other teams that are going to certainly fight for that that spot in Class A. And, of course, that is going to be played in Sioux Falls. So that'll be a great tournament. And then, of course, the AA's are out in Rapid City. Sioux Falls, Washington is going to try to do something that has been done in AA basketball where the girls and the boys win the tournament the same year. Brandon Valley did it recently. O'Gorman has done it. Now Sioux Falls, Washington, the top seed for the boys, they're going to try to do what the Washington girls did last week and win a title. But they got O'Gorman to go through. They got Yankton with Matthew Moores down there. It will be, and then Roosevelt, too. That is going to be a tough tournament. The AA is out in Rapid City.
Yeah, we've got a little Washington-Roosevelt back-and-forth competition going here at SDPB. So we'll see how that shakes out. Are there stories that you want to share with us about the coaches or the athletes? I mean, my favorite parts are always, you know, what's happening behind the scoreboard is some of these athletes had to sit out last year, you know, painfully waiting. Tell me some of those stories of who you're looking forward to seeing back on the court.
Well, at least here in the Class B tournament, you have five of the eight coaches who are coaching their alma mater, which is a great story. Here are coaches that went to high school and then later came back and now coaching their alma mater. Some of them have their own sons playing, or their nephew or their cousin. Lower Brule, by the way, with Brian LaRoche, he has like three players on his roster that he is related to. So that family bond is always great to follow. And you know, each town has that family atmosphere, and they'll bring some fans here to Wachs Arena here in Aberdeen.
Yeah. So it was very important, the decision that Governor Kristi Noem made last year, and that the High School Sports Authority and the athletic directors, there was just a lot of conversations and heartbreak as things were shut down or tickets were reduced. What does it mean for some of these athletes, Craig, to sort of be back? Some had to sit out their senior year, but some of them are back after being juniors or, you know, first-year players.
Yeah, it was the big hit, you know, the Class B tournament for the girls last week. Only three of the teams that were there a year ago made it this year. And even on the college end, we talked about the University of South Dakota or Northern up here in Aberdeen, they all had really good teams. They all had great expectations. And then pretty much the rug pulled out from under them. And so for some of these teams to get back after having that frustration from a year ago, it's like new life for them. It is a way for them to try to relive what happened a year ago and play basketball.
Yeah. All right, I cut you off earlier with the time, so we'll let people know that the A's are on SDPB2, the B's SDPB TV1, the AA's SDPB TV3. Tell us a little bit about tip-off and how this unfolds this week.
Yep, noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain. Things get going tomorrow, and that will be for each day on Friday and Saturday. The coverage begins. Hey, and if you want to catch my new podcast, it's called In Play with Craig Maddock. We do some great high school sports stories. Just go to sdpb.org/basketball, and there's some great stories that I've done here with basketball stories over the last few months. So I would appreciate that, and give us a 5-star on that as well. How about that?
Absolutely.
For a free plug.
Well worth it. I love In Play with Craig Maddock. I'm a big fan. Thank you so much, Craig, for being here with us today.
Lori, thanks. Let's talk again soon.
All right. You can follow all our coverage on Twitter, SDPB Sports, and on Facebook. Find all the details about the state basketball boys tournaments at sdpb.org.